Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. So, let's get intimate. Let's get emotionally intimate. And what does that mean? Let's talk about emotions, about our own emotions, about being intimate with our emotions so we know them better, can understand ourselves better, can be clearer, and have a richer life because we're intimate with our own emotions. And to help us be that way is a guest who wrote a book called Emotional Intimacy. And it's a comprehensive guide for connecting with the power of your emotions. So I wanted to introduce our guest. The author of the book is Robert Augustus Masters. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm so glad that you could be with us because this has been a journey for me to read your book. It's a journey through myself, through my fears, my shame, my anger, so many things that I got in touch with and understood better because of reading your book, Emotional Intimacy. It's so important, and you've written many books. You're a well-known author who really understands what we need to hear and know about ourselves to be responsible to ourselves, right? And this is an opportunity to be friends with our emotions. Why should we be friends with our emotions?
Because they're an intrinsic part of us, and if we don't know them well, then we're missing out on a big piece of ourselves. Plus, if we don't know them well, they're probably still going to arise. It will arise, and perhaps we'll do some harm because we're not in charge of them, we're not aware of them, we don't see them, we're not intimate with them. If a man, for example, doesn't recognize his shame, he may just simply be overly aggressive in many situations. Once he understands that aggression often emerges from shame, then he has a chance to work with that more skillfully.
Right, and this is something that I worked with on another show about the difference between men and women, and men will plug into shame pretty quickly. And in order to avoid it and get angry or run away.
I think that men and women have the same shame levels to start with for a while. But then once boys are acculturated into being boys in a conventional sense, there's almost an inherent shaming, like, you know, phrases like man up, be a man, things like that. Will shame a boy, and his response will be either to crumble completely or to try and prove himself. In either case, he's being driven by his shame, and his common solution, and it's of course celebrated in our culture, is to get aggressive,
right?
Very aggressive. Perhaps somehow that's an entirely positive trait.
When I was young, I couldn't rise to the occasion. I couldn't be the man I wanted to be as a teenager and a young man. I really failed so many times, and it turned out that after college, I decided to be a man, and I took up karate. I became a third-degree black belt. I needed that, and still there's a part of me that has other aspects of myself that I worry about.
Well, see, when you do that, which is admirable in a certain sense, a lot of the rest of you gets pushed into the shadows, the things that aren't considered so masculine in our culture, like vulnerability, sensitivity, softness, which I think are really important for a man to have in his toolkit.
Right. And I thought I had too much of that.
Yeah, it can over-soften us, and then you can kind of prove to yourself that you are indeed a man, because you got your third-degree black belt, or you made a lot of money, or you're with a woman most other men wish they were with, that type of thing, where men are so caught in that. And when a man gets free of that, I found over the decades, they become just as emotionally literate as women, able to feel, resonate, be subtle, be nuanced, and yet still have a spine, still have testicles, so to speak.
Right, right. There's a combination of factors that can make us more whole.
Yeah.
Now, the book is so helpful in understanding what emotions are, how to identify our emotions, how to clarify how our emotions speak to us. And you,
well, it sounds almost self-evident for some, like, okay, well, of course, we get angry, we get sad, we get fearful, et cetera, et cetera. But for a lot of people, mostly men, there's a sense of not being able to distinguish them very well. I've had men in sessions who could not say what they were feeling. Even when they were angry, they didn't register it as anger until they were taught, this is anger. Sense how the blood flow to your hands, your facial expression, what you're thinking about your partner. We don't have emotional literacy 101 in our educational system, which is bizarre to me because it's such an essential part of becoming more human, more fully human, is to know our emotions. And we're, as men, acculturated away from knowing them, whereas women get to know them more. They have their own problems with emotions, but at least there's a sense of having some closeness to them. It's okay for them to be emotional. You know, if I want to insult someone, if I say you're being emotional, it can be an insult. If I say to the same person you're being rational, not an insult. And yet rationality can be extremely harmful when it's handled unskillfully.
Yes. But you also talk a lot about gender in the book and the differences between our genders and the similarities of them as well. But you talk about how women are much more emotionally facile, but when they express anger, it's not appreciated the same way that people look at men.
No, you're right. We have less flattering labels for female anger in our culture. So we tend to ennoble male anger and male aggression as well, as if somehow it's quite kind of a good thing a lot of the time. Whereas for a woman, she's angry, she's pissed off, and basically our only big label for that is bitch. There's a complete put-down in there, there's a shaming. And many women, because of that, try to find their power in indirect ways. Although we're seeing more and more women, of course, who are really stepping into their anger in a way that is beautiful, meaning that there's some heart in it. You know, the highest level of anger for me is heart anger, meaning you're always feeling some degree of compassion for the person you're pissed off at. So you never quite fully dehumanize them, and therefore you're less likely to harm them.
Well, what I liked a lot in reading the book is that you talk about emotions on both sides, the healthy expression of each emotion and the unhealthy expression of it. And so then we can look at ourselves and understand which side of the coin we're working with. And I found that very helpful. Also, you clarify which are primary emotions and which are combination emotions. And that was very helpful to me to understand how to discern and name the emotions.
I know in the literature on emotions, there's certain ones that are universally acknowledged to be primary, like fear, anger, and shame. Not always shame. Sometimes people don't leave that off the list. But for me, the light went on when I realized that all the primary emotions could coexist with compassion.
Well,
I can be angry at you and feel compassion. I feel some disgust and feel compassion. But once I've gone to certain other emotions, like contempt or guilt, no compassion.
Right, and that's what I liked. You're always looking at the healthy side and the unhealthy, and there are some emotions that just don't have a healthy side. But
no.
Shame, actually, I don't know why people would leave it out, because what is it a combination of? It has its own feeling.
Yes, and it's I've of course distinguished it from guilt in my book. In my clinical experience, I've seen that for three plus decades. Unfortunately, in our culture now, shame is almost always given a totally negative connotation, like it's a bad thing, and we should not have it, and here's some antidotes. And I think, well, good luck, because someone who's doesn't have shame can be quite a dangerous person. In our language, we often say that he was shameless, as if to imply some shame is needed. And of course, I see shame as the herald of conscience. Without shame, we wouldn't access our conscience.
Right.
Whereas a lot of us, we will confuse our conscience with our inner critic or our guilt. And the whole area is very muddled, but shame is a very obvious emotion when you stay with it. You know, the head hangs, there's a droop, you feel bad, your mind gets a little discombobulated.
And that's
how
the
body
feels.
Everyone's seen how the dog looks like when a dog is shamed.
Right, right. But it's also an inner feeling of helplessness that I had shame many times when I was young in my growth and my abilities to handle different situations that I didn't handle well.
Yeah.
And it was really a self-shame much more than being shamed directly, although I I did have a lot of people many times in my life telling me I was good for nothing.
We're so absorbent, and we internalize the shame that's coming our way, and we usually don't question it at all until we're maybe in our teens.
Yeah, I took it within. And I really believed people because I had so much input into being a good-for-nothing who would never amount to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I really got to a place where I was in total self-doubt and felt like I must be a terrible person.
Yeah.
But the healthy part of that is that it drove me to find answers and to discover myself and to find my strength.
So pretty slope there, though, because some people wouldn't be driven that way. They would just sink further and further into feeling crushed, maybe getting suicidal, becoming adults who are just plagued with self-doubt with an industrial strength inner critic. I mean, one of the quickest ways to work with this is to identify one's inner critic and start to relate to it instead of from it. I've had many people give their inner critic a name and say, your homework is every time it arises, you notice it, just name it, just say hello to it. And shift your awareness to your breathing, your belly, your legs. Don't get lost in the content.
Yes, and there are many different techniques to use to create perspective in our lives and to find out, okay, I might not be good at this one thing, but I'm great at this other thing.
You know, the trouble is with us men, especially, and we don't think we're that good at something, not that competent, we'll tend to lean to our strengths, or our strengths obscure our weaknesses. We don't want to go to the places where we feel unmanned or unmanly. Like when we're hit by shame, everyone kind of crumples, and it's, in some cultures, that's a cause for, you know, killing oneself in samurai Japan, you know, like, you
sure.
Don't lose face. And of course, you or I get really shamed or we're crying or really angry too, but especially the vulnerable emotions, we are losing face.
Yes, and then it's about our own self-love and self-worth ability to climb through it.
And to start to love the you who was first crushed by shame, overwhelmed by anger, terrified by, you know, there's a sense of turning toward what's young and vulnerable in us. And every man I've ever worked with, every man has a boy in him, a boyish, pre-rational, innocent, vulnerable side. And if a man's out of touch with that part of himself, or a woman, that part of herself in her, it just makes life much more difficult, and it tends to make our relationships more challenging, way too challenging.
Right. Well, one thing that you talk about that's really important is the value of the difficult emotions in our lives,
mm-hmm.
and that there are, and I've run into this, where there are spiritual people who say, well, you're just dealing with emotions, you know, you have to get spiritual, and then you just totally ignore all those things and meditate, and then it all goes away because you're so spiritual.
Yeah, sure, it sure doesn't go away. I have an entire book on this called Spiritual Bypassing.
I saw that, and
you'd enjoy it, I think, because it's basically about using spiritual practices and beliefs to avoid dealing with emotional difficulties, relational hassles, developmental tasks, and it's very, very, very common, and it's not acknowledged that much, and especially in certain spiritual circles where one is taught that, you know, if you're really moving on high up in the spiritual path. Emotions, what are those? But you know what? I think emotions follow us all the way up and down the developmental ladder. There's reports of very, very advanced teachers getting really angry, often in unclean ways, but showing anger, showing displeasure, or being inappropriate with their students sexually, like showing signs of not being fully developed across the board.
Right,
they're lopsided development. They can access deep spiritual states, but they are not in a position to deal with their full humanness, and unfortunately that gets transmitted to most of their students, who then make it a virtue to not get emotional, or if they do, they think something's wrong with me, and there's the shame, oh my God, if I was a better spiritual student or disciple, I wouldn't be feeling anger or lust or fear. Well, I'd just be feeling joy.
I always tell people that our souls have come here to a very difficult planet to experience difficult emotions so we can grow in our compassion and our love through through trouble, adversity. Mm-hmm. And so that's our spiritual path, is to do that.
Mm-hmm. And that, another way of saying that, suffering is grace, can be grace. And I mean, some of my deepest work is just teaching people how to turn toward the difficult, turn toward the painful, and realize, you know what? There's no avoiding the pain here. It's just part of this, what we're in. And we might as well learn how to work with it skillfully. And as you were saying, use it to heal and awaken ourselves.
Yes.
Which doesn't, of course, justify a lot of the awful conditions on the planet, but given that they're there, we might as well work with them. We might as well turn toward them. And if we don't do so, we cannot be of any help to those that are still really stuck there.
Right. And feel the richness of it when we're in it, understanding that this is, these are deep levels of compassion and feeling that, that have incredible richness to them. And then the more we become familiar with it, the more clear we get and the easier it is to hold it.
But to do that, you have to become vulnerable.
Yes, and it's hard because it's physical as well. Mm-hmm. Emotions are carried through our bodies. And the problem is that when we're not actually letting it move through our bodies, it gets stuck there, and that's when diseases show up.
Mm-hmm. Get stuck in certain spots. I mean, it's almost universal. When someone's not as caught in fear a lot, their solar plexus area is contracted and tight. Someone's really in a lot of anger, the jaw. It's not labeled on the same in every person, but I do a lot of work with the body because that's, the emotions aren't just in the body, but they also involve the body. And the funny thing is, or the beautiful thing is, when you go to the core of a difficult emotion and you're right in it, not just thinking about it, you're in it and you're feeling it and expressing it in a safe environment, the vulnerability is almost too much, almost unbearable. And yet, staying with that leads you through the other side. And I've had seen many clients have profound spiritual breakthroughs without trying to have them because they went to the core of their wounding. They felt the helplessness right to the core, the fear, the hurt, the grief, the loss, and suddenly they were vaulted into a joy that was very grounded but hugely expansive because they'd risked everything to go in there. It takes great courage to cross that final barrier into total vulnerability.
Well, and you say to go in there, and you have there's a segment of your book that you talk about our language of emotion and how we see the body as a container so that we can use that language to describe our feelings, like blowing the lid or blowing your gasket or going through the roof or being bottled up or being drained, being filled with sorrow. And you talk about that. You know, I really appreciated how we can use those languages. And I'm sure that you do that in your work so that you can help people identify their bodies and see their bodies as this container of emotions, and then it helps to work with it. It's a tool then.
It's a tool. It's also useful to look at where language excuses us. Like a lot of our language will say, well, I was overcome with this, or I feel like I couldn't control this, or my feelings got away from me. We treat it in so many different ways.
Right.
But the thing is to shift from it, emotion being this kind of distant it that we are the victims of or we have to control, to is actually an essential aspect of our being. And then we start to realize that we are not actually a container for what we call the self. We're actually an expression of that. Then we become more embodied, and our emotions teach us to stay embodied, because you can't really become intimate with an emotion without knowing it somatically as well as psychologically and spiritually and emotionally, etc.
Right. There's a feeling in me when I'm upset of being disjointed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why one of my problems in life is having joint problems.
Uh-huh.
And I work on that, and I'm doing pretty well.
Yeah,
but it's still, I see the language of that. And you also talk about, and you just mentioned that there are physical action descriptions of working with our emotions, like flowing into a rage, wrestling with our feelings, fighting fear, being swept off our feet. And when we can put these languages to it, then we can help create the story of it and create more discernment about it.
Yeah, the metaphor is a lot more precision. If I just say, you know, in a clinical way, but I'm showing the affect of anger. It doesn't tell me nearly as much as if I tell you that I'm simmering, not quite boiling. It gives you a sense of where I'm at internally, and of course the metaphors are somatically very accurate. So we like to have people we work with get very, very specific in the description of emotion and to track it.
Yeah, and you talk about, I made a list here, and you had a list of different textures or directionality, density, temperature, color, intensity, movement, and interactions with other emotions. There are so many ways that we can describe, and that was very helpful to me reading your book, was I could feel my emotions better. I could discern them. I could interpret and work with them better, and actually forgive them better.
Yeah.
That was big.
It's interesting to say, to take an emotion like contempt that can seem a little, what is that? If you put your face in the position of that particular emotion, most emotions have a very specific facial display, you'll probably start to feel. Then you can notice, what's it feel like in my back as opposed to my guts, my shoulders? And what shape is it? I want to say I have a book called Ending Our Suffering by Entering Our Pain. It's called Meeting the Dragon. And that's full of details, descriptions of working with difficulty or pain in terms of its shape, directionality, color, texture, temperature. That just means you get more of a precise exploration of it. And if you're, say you're angry and you lay down, you don't need to, it's not so heated, you have to express it. You can just lay there and just notice, where do I feel the anger in my body the most? Where does it feel most heated? If it had a shape, what would it be? Is there movement? That generates more and more curiosity about what one's feeling. And when that happens, then emotional intimacy is not that far away.
Yeah, it feels just right to be able to do that. It's so interesting. There's so many points in this book that I was excited about, and each point you're telling me that, oh, you have a book about that.
Well, they all kind of work together. I have a book on relationship called Transformation Through Intimacy. So we have people want to work with us for in groups, trainings, individual work. We say, first step, you have to read these books, Spiritual Bypassing, Transformation Through Intimacy, Emotional Intimacy, and I have a course on shadow work, 6 CDs. That just makes sure they're very well prepared. And of course, all these things work together.
And
like one whole.
And the job is half done by the time they get to you.
It is. They're warmed up. And if they don't like it, they don't like me, then, well, it's good. We know ahead of time there's no point working with me.
Right.
And if they resonate with it, they're going to be even more able to make good use of their time with myself and my wife, Diane, with whom I do all my work.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I feel that we have to want to face our pain.
And the sad thing is, or maybe it's not so sad, most of us don't reach that point without being clobbered pretty hard by different events, situations. I know in my case, I got going on this path in my 20s. I had an extremely painful relationship breakup, and I was very armored. I was tough. I was aggressive, et cetera, et cetera. That broke me, and I hated it. But after a while, I started to feel a sense of gratitude that I was able to finally cry hard, feel, expand, love people more. And that became because I had reached a point of such agony I could no longer contain myself. And most people I know have had experiences like that that really cracked them open, shook them up.
Right. And I did too. I had a very painful divorce at one point. It took me a couple of years to rediscover myself. Fortunately, some years later, I found my current wife, and we've been together for 34 years.
Oh, that's a nice long time.
Yeah, we're very happy, and we do work on our emotions pretty well together.
But the previous one, in a way, was it prepared you, didn't it?
Well, yeah, and it also made me so much grateful to be loved in a way that is affirming.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel affirmed by my wife, and it's a big deal, because I came from so much struggle, and it takes that to be a good wounded healer. We have to
know the territory.
Exactly.
So if someone comes to me and they're having anxiety attacks, or they've had a terrifying experience, I'm at home with it. I've been there. So then they can tell right away I've been there. So we don't have to cover that ground as to why they should trust me with it. There's an inherent knowing.
Yes,
and that's
sure.
So crucial. And, of course, I look back at my history. How did I gather the things I know? I didn't deliberately go for them. They were in there, and I, for better or for worse, hung in there and got knocked around a lot and came through it with more learning.
Not only learning, compassion.
Passion.
Compassion, and add passion to it. It's really, I think, that the wisdom that you developed from the pain creates compassion for everyone else's pain.
Yeah, I've often seen people, for example, when they were in deep grief, and we're working with them, and they're just crying their guts out, they're shaking, heaving, they're doing all that, and it's sitting, it's safe, and more often than not, they shift from my grief to our grief to the grief. Not all in the same session, but sometimes there's a sense of being flung into the universal, feeling great, great compassion for everyone's suffering.
Right.
Not just one's own, not in an intellectual way, but in a way you feel it right to your core.
Right. We're all
and
in
you can't
together.
Do that if you haven't opened to that depth yourself. Once you have, then you can resonate with those who also are enduring collective fear or whatever it is.
That's right. It is. And you get into a spiritual aspect in the book. And you probably have a book on spirituality and emotions. And it's understandable that if we're all one together, that your pain is my pain,
mm-hmm.
and we can identify it, it's just different stories about it.
Yeah, once you get that, it's profound. Once you get that what you do to another person, you're doing to yourself, not in a New Age conceptual fashion, but you really get it, it makes a huge difference.
And a great sense of responsibility, too.
Yeah, and freedom. It's just there. Here it is. And for me, I often feel like I don't have a choice in the work I'm doing, especially during our trainings and groups. And I love that. I don't have a choice. I have to be there. I have to be at my best. I have to be present the entire time. And be absolutely intuitive, because I can't rely on a preset structure.
Right.
I've learned to trust that. And what guides me the most is my caring for the other people and reading their energy, movements, all the subtleties of expression. And that guides me moment to moment to moment. That's what I train therapists to do, or counselors who come to work with us. And that's the hardest thing, is how to trust that innate sense of connection and flow.
Right. I think on a spiritual level, you already see them as whole, and you just want to bring them back to that.
That's the beginning point. Instead of that being the end point, we've arrived, that to me is the beginning. Acknowledging that our unity of being is not like the goal, it's the foundation. Once you do that, then you get to work with relationship, difficulties, challenges of making money, all the challenges of life. It becomes your curriculum once you've had that kind of initial awakening.
Right, and people feel that in you, and they hold that, and you help them hold it so that they can manage the pain that you're asking them to
mm-hmm.
move toward. And this is all about moving toward pain so that...
It's as if I'm giving them permission, tacit permission, to be in as much pain as they actually are, and they can feel it, and it pours out, and then other people see it in the room, and they're touched by it, and it's not just a pain fest, it's actually coming alive, really alive, and realizing what had to be held back when we were younger, what had to be immobilized when we were younger, and liberating that
yes.
step by step so
right.
that we can be fully alive human beings.
Right. It's a problem-solving process.
Yeah, and without emotional intimacy, can't do it.
Right. And so we're nearing the end of the show. And you mentioned emotional intimacy, which happens to be the title of the book. And your name is Robert Augustus Masters. Do you have a website?
Yeah, robertmasters.com.
Okay, and they can purchase books there?
It'll tell them how. I'm selling, most of my publishers can sell them more. It's better to do it through Amazon. Amazon's probably the best place to buy the books.
Okay, good.
And the CD set is a company called SoundsTrue.com. It's the world's largest distributor and maker of spoken word audio.
Oh, so your books are also audio?
No, this that one is called Knowing Your Shadow. It's 6 hours of how to work with shadow, you know, that with being whatever we keep in the dark in ourselves or deny about ourselves. The other ones are, if a person goes to my website, though, they can find everything they want.
It's amazing how prolific you are.
I'm amazed by it too. I think, my God, how did I do that? I feel so exhausted. I'm doing a book right now on men. I'm in the editing process for Sounds True, and it's exhausting. But I have to say, most of them, I feel happily exhausted.
Well, I'm so glad that you're willing to exhaust yourself doing this, because your books are, this one book is wonderful.
I appreciate how thoroughly you read it.
Well, thank you. I got a lot out of it. I can tell you that. So thank you so much for being a guest on Energy Stew.
Okay. My pleasure.
And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I look forward to hearing from you. Please call. I'd love to hear from you. And thank you so much for listening.